left. And 15 and 16 platoons were placed under command of B Company. And this was to be a daylight assault up this mountain behind an artillery and mortar barrage. And the mountain, there were Germans on it. It wasn't known how many there were or what type of defenses they had. But as I mentioned before, it was a fairly fluid, open type of war at that time. And the Germans didn't have that many people in Sicily as yet. So this thing was mounted up, and the barrage came down, and 15 platoon was on the right under Christie, and I was on the left. And we started up this mountain. And again, what you did is you simply advanced, and you tried to keep as close to the barrage as ever possible. That was your only salvation. If you got that the barrage get too far in advance, you were completely exposed. And you took the risk that there might be shortfalls of shells, which happened. It couldn't be avoided, but that was a risk that you just had to take. So we followed behind the barrage just as quickly. It was sort of a creeping barrage up this hill. We followed behind just as close as we could, and I must say it was pretty good. And we all had faith in our own supporting arms. That was something too. It was kind of like, you know, like I suppose when the astronauts take off, they've got to have faith in their machine. Well, we had faith in the artillery and the mortars, and in due course, we got right up near the summit where the Germans were, and they were pretty mad. And there was a very, very sharp gunfight took place, and I got hit in the elbow here. I think I must have had my Tommy gun up, I think they hit my Tommy gun, and I got shell fragments in this arm, and I also got a buddy good bolt right through my buddy helmet. And that saved me, I guess, because it went right in the front of the helmet, came around out the back, and knocked me down. And I had a batman, I can't remember his name now. Another thing. And it was a German machine gun nest, about 10 yards just up from us. So this fellow worked his way around and tossed a grenade in and put them out of commission. Well then, I came to and tried to continue fighting, by this time we'd taken the ridge. But my platoon commander was killed, my platoon sergeant rather was killed. Christie, the 15 platoon commander, was killed. His platoon sergeant was killed. There was pretty major casualties in both platoons. I was badly wounded, and we took the objective. And again, I sort of thought this was just sort of, ordinary platoon fare. Anyway, stretcher bearer who packed me out now lives here in Victoria. He's on the executive of our regimental association. And, he bought my helmet back, and unfortunately it was stolen. But he was going to give it to my mother. I'm not sure what her reaction would have been. His name is Jack Child. He was a stretcher bearer and a fine person, one of the finest people I know. And he tells me the story. I'm bleeding like a damn chicken, you know how you cut a chicken's head off. That's the way it is. These things were bleeding, but they patched it up and so forth and sent me back. And they dripped off my shirt, I guess, and I I didn't have the insignia on, so. I remember at one, not the first aid station, but one further back, when they were herding me into some sort of compound, I said, just a moment, I said, I'm an officer. And they, somebody looked at me and said, what, you're an officer? I said, well, it may not look like it, but I am. So I was out then until for the rest of the Italian campaign. And I was evacuated out to North Africa. And then I rejoined the battalion partway up the shank of Italy.
And for that operation, when we just talked about, you were given the military?
I got the military cross for that, yeah.
Did that surprise you?
Yes, I just thought this was just, you know, just
normal
stuff. Quite frankly, I mean, to me, it's just a matter of doing what you're assigned to do. But it was a successful operation, and we took the objective. But my God, we did lose a lot of people doing it. A lot of good people.
And whereabouts in Italy? Where are you when you returned to the regiment? Where was
it? Well, I'm just trying to remember the name of the place. The battalion had gone. The battalion had gone into a rest area, Campo Basso. And I rejoined them just, I think, before Campo Basso. And unfortunately, apparently, I'd beaten the gun a bit, because I had, when I was in North Africa, I also got jaundice and suspected malaria. So. They wanted to keep me out of action for quite some time, but I got over to Italy, and then I was able to get a truck up to the battalion, and I was able to join them. So I was AWL from the from their holding unit, but the battalion eventually was able to straighten this thing out. But just before Campo Basso, and I rejoined D Company. I think I had my old platoon back, 15th platoon, yes.
A lot of different faces in it by the time?
Yes, there were. Jim Stone was, I think Jim Stone had been commanding. He may not have commanded, it may not have been him. I can't remember that, you know, that much, but he certainly was in command of D Company when I rejoined him in the Campo Basso area. So there were different faces, but they were all pretty battle-hardened faces by this time.
How were replacements treated? I'd heard from a captain in the PPCLI that they were poorly treated, really. They were called conscripts, and another word they used was zombies. They called them zombies.
Well, no, I wouldn't agree with that. We did have the selective service people, and, you know, at one stage, the government of Canada, who had promised never to send selective service people overseas, after great pressure from the military and from the English-speaking portions of Canada, and also from General McNaughton, I think. You remember the Crerar and McNaughton were involved in this. They were sent overseas. And we knew, you could tell by their number, whether they were volunteers or selective service. And although we may, in our regiment, although we may have thought of them as zombies, they were never called zombies. And a lot of these people were, well, quite frankly, I had a couple in my company later on that were MAs. And they were more sort of, they'd be, I think if we went to war now, we'd have quite a few of them. They were more sort of objectors than they were sort of I don't even call them pacifists. It's hard to describe them. They were prepared to do their duty. I tried to get one chap to become a corporal. He was just excellent, just excellent. And he said, no, he said, I will do my job. And they said, they sent me over as a private. I'll do my job as a private. And that's all I'll do. And I said, well, I really can't ask that much more of you. But I said, really? I said, you should have a commission. You've got all the ability. You've got the know-how. I'm prepared to promote you to corporal right now. Thank you, but no.
I think every private I've talked with has said the same thing, that he was offered a commission, but he turned it down.
Well, yeah. But some of them, we try not to distinguish, but may I say this? Can I make some general comments about this? I think that when the war broke out, as I mentioned before, there had been terribly difficult times in Canada, particularly in Western Canada, where we had the economic problems, plus the Dust Bowl and all sorts of related handicaps. And when the war broke out, there were a lot of young men who saw this as an opportunity to get out of this terrible trap in which they found themselves. And they leapt at the opportunity. And I think it was a tremendous thing, good thing for Canada, that they did this and that they were able to do this. Because they were fine people. They were fine people. Many of them were, by the standards in those days, they were relatively well educated. They were experienced, many of them. Many that joined the Edmonton Regiment came from the land. The Art Regiment was pretty good, particularly in sort of open warfare and also in sort of night fighting and infiltration. This is where we shone. And we'd all had experience back in Alberta in getting acquainted with land and moving through land and moving through the country. So these people were a pretty tough bunch. They had to be a pretty tough bunch to survive during those terrible depression years. I remember when I was a student, like you, when I got my job with the topographical survey, I got $5 a day. That was heaven. Because otherwise, I worked under contract for my uncles, and they paid me $5 a day as what they call a spike picture. Where you work from 5 o'clock in the morning till 10 o'clock at night in a threshing outfit, where you spike the sheaves up onto the top of the rack, and that is work. So these people who went into the battalion early in the war were pretty tough and pretty reliant bunch. Some were may have been a bit rough around the gills, as we say, but many became very polished, many were commissioned, many have done extremely well after the war, and during the war. But then we got the NRMA people, what do they call them, National Resources Mobilization Act or something like that, people who were coming over, and they were a bit of a different breed. They didn't have the same spirit, obviously the same spirit moving them. Except, I think, in the case of Quebec, there was not the same compulsion on political grounds. Many of the people in Quebec saw no reason to to save Britain. They never regarded Britain as the homeland at all. They regarded Britain as the oppressor. So there's a little different political approach there. And don't forget that one of our most illustrious prime ministers was someone who successfully avoided going into military service, although he was of the right age. But he's able to defend his action on the grounds of politics and belief and so forth and so on. And I suppose a case can be made. So you have this sort of difference of approach. And I suppose there must have been some feeling in the ranks between the volunteers and the other people. I suppose there must have been. And as far as the officers were concerned, we knew who were volunteers and who weren't. Mind you, some who had been drafted then later volunteered, so there's no way of knowing, so it was fine. But we did know if they were still drafted, and we knew by their number, as far as I can recall, that they had been drafted. So there was that distinction.
Okay. Let's go back to Italy. And
yeah.
Where were we at?
Oh, God. Campobasso.
Campobasso.
Yeah. Well, I can't remember too much except from up until the approaches to Ortona. And Ortona, the Sangro, the Moro River, the Sangro, the Moro, and Ortona, I suppose, was the first big battle after Sicily that the Canadians were involved in. As I mentioned, I was back as commanding 16th Platoon and D Company. Jim Stone was the company commander. And we were in action, but not dreadfully so, on the Moro. We had safely crossed the Sangro, following the footsteps of other people. There'd been various schemes for our deployment which scared the daylights out of me, because they were all, seemed to be rather grandiose schemes, coming as it did when, in fact, the winter rains were fast approaching. But anyway, the first major encounter took place on the road on the approach to Ortona, a place called what we call Vino Ridge. And on the attack, this was, I suppose, around the early part of December 1943. And D Company and another company, whom I can't recall, were the lead companies, supported by tanks, to advance on the sort of road toward Ortona, which was the main highway junction for the east and west and north and south. It also had a port on the Adriatic, Amsquetta. Transportation-wise, it was more important than it was as a city. It wasn't much as a city. Transportation-wise, it was important. We advanced without any difficulty until we hit this bit of high ground, which later was called Vino Ridge. It's called Vino Ridge because it was a couple with vineyards. And suddenly, we met stiff resistance. Several tanks were knocked out. We came under mortar and machine gun fire and anti-tank fire. We deployed around to the right. We met increasing fire. We could hear, in fact, the German officers giving shouting directions to their mortars and to their anti-tank guns, so we were obviously pretty damn close. And we were forced to pull back and consolidate at the base of the ridge. The rest of the battalion brigade came up. In due course, the whole of the Canadian division was strung out along that line. I think there were very, very few reserves. I'm not sure if there were any, but this was one of the things I think that did happen, that most of the division was committed. And there had been various attacks that were made, which you will be well aware, all of which were repulsed. We had made some, we suffered heavy casualties. And the rains did come to some extent. We were still in the line. My own activity was restricted to occasional patrols. And we carried out a couple of successful patrols. And then the plan was made to attack Ortona by a massive artillery barrage, one of the largest in the war. This was after Major Paul Triquet had made his breakthrough to Casa Berardi on the left and had captured a very vital crossroads, which opened the gully, which where the Germans. The trouble wasn't being originally Germans were in the gully just behind it, and we couldn't get at them with our artillery or our tanks. And the barrage went in. I would think around the 19th or 20th of December. I think it was called Morning Glory. I'm not sure. And D Company was the advance company on the left, and I think that C Company was on the right. We were supported by the Ontario tanks. I think that the C force were attacking further over to the right along the coast road. We went to our startup area. The moment came, the barrage came crashing down, and in we went. And this was quite a long attack. And again, my theory was that follow as close as possible behind it. There might be the odd short shell, but better that than being machine gunned. So we followed right, I would say, within 75 yards on the barrage. We did have a bit of protection from short shells by a railway embankment on our right. And we were actually able to overrun most of the German positions, and we took quite a few prisoners. A few Germans were able to escape, not many. I did see some, but they had a system of sort of zigzag trenches, and they'd pop out of there like Buddy Jackrabbits. And, you had to have a shotgun to get them, I guess. But not many, and we pressed right on. We were able to get to them when they were still right down in their trenches and dugouts. And that afternoon, we were right in the outskirts of Ortona. And we consolidated. We'd suffered some casualties. We suffered more casualties during the evening. The next morning, we were ordered to attack into the main sector of Ortona, but this meant going across a Well, a space, yes, I suppose you could call it an empty space. It looked to be about a mile wide, but I suppose it wasn't more than 75 or 100 yards. And I remember Jim Stone sent one platoon in, and it was almost annihilated. And when the company was down to about, I think it was 18, he divided it into three squads. And he commanded one squad, I commanded one squad, and the company sergeant major commanded the other squad. And I claim that we then drew straws, or we tossed a coin as to who would, they were still insisting that we attack. Jim Stone and I differ now on the interpretation of it, but my recollection is that we either drew straws or tossed a coin as to who was going to lead the attack, lead another attack across this open ground, because it was obviously suicidal. And with my usual good luck, I lost it. So all I asked was that, I didn't make any last will or any last request or anything. I did ask if Jim could, lay down a few smoke bombs along the line of the village. We could see the German machine gun positions there. And he got the company mortars. And I think he did it himself. And at the given moment, we charged in line, single file, and there was a little ditch. And I always found dealing with the Germans trying to do the unexpected. So I thought, hell, we're going to get killed anyway. So at least if we go down this ditch, one gun at the end will get us all. But we at least have protection, a wee bit of protection from the side. So we just went down this little shallow ditch. And we must have done that, that 100 yards. That fellow was not the first one to make the 100 yards in 10 seconds, whatever it was. But we got down there without losing anybody and got into this building, and the Germans were still in it. And, we got up on the second floor and fixed them up. And this was the first paratroop division. They were tough babies. And I remember that in the back and on the street there was one of their NCOs who had been hit by a grenade, and he was lying there, and we called on him to surrender, and he fired back at us. So what do you do? And by getting up on this, this one floor above the level, we were then able to look down into all these German machine gun posts. So Jim and the rest came across again, not losing any time, and we were able to give them covering fire, and they got in. And then we got some snipers across, and they were able to dispose of these people in this, the one that didn't surrender, to be able to dispose of them. So this there's a bit of a breakthrough came there. I can't remember too much after that, except that we had house-to-house fighting, and there were tremendous casualties, and I got a whole flock of reinforcements, and we were going to launch an attack down the main street. There was a big pile of rubble, and I was up at this pile of rubble with Jim Stone, because the Germans were just beyond that. And we were sort of looking it over and trying to lay our plans, because the idea was not to attack in the open, but to try and utilize the houses and the doorways and so forth. And I went back to get my sort of platoon and a bunch of reinforcements. They were being thrown in then, pretty green. And a bunch of reinforcements were coming down the street, and they weren't sticking to the bloody doorway, and they were down the street, and a mortar bomb came over, bang, right in the middle of them. And I don't know how many casualties there were, but they were all either killed or badly wounded. And I got a fragment in my knee, which I didn't know at that time. That seriously depleted the size of my platoon. So anyway, we carried on fighting that day, and toward evening, Jim Stone said, "What's the matter with your leg?" I said, "Nothing, sir." He said, "What the hell are you dragging it for?" And I hadn't noticed, but apparently it sort of wasn't functioning. So he called the stretcher bearer over, and pulled it up, and damn, here's a bloody hole in the leg and bleeding, and you know. So out. And so I spent, that was the 24th of December, and I asked if I could stay for Christmas Day. And M.O. agreed to this. He was a friend, and I stayed for Christmas. And then I was evacuated on the 26th of December, and was sent right back to the hospital, and they put the thing in a cat. They didn't try to take off the pieces. The piece of wrap was still there. And every time they x-rayed me, people would say, "My God," they say, "you've got something in there. We'll have to do further tests and studies. It's some mass, you know. It's a piece of shrapnel." Anyway, so I didn't rejoin the regiment after that until after Ortona. And I came back up and I'd be promoted to captain at that stage. And I was then chief instructor at a street fighting school in Ortona. And if you've ever seen a film called The Road to Ortona, I've got a copy here, in fact. We provided part of the scenario for this film, which was shown as the actual Battle of Ortona. And here are my people, you know, with their nice clean packs and uniforms and so forth, rushing around the ruins. And then after that, I went as a second in command to C Company with a chap named Harold Tucker. This was, I think, in February, March 1944. And the next major battle was the battle of the Leary Valley and the Hitler line. We were taking the complete shift across Italy from the Adriatic side, right across through the mountains on a security move. A ship that I was able to trace the route of last year when I was in Italy with the Command and Staff College. And my only observation was that what took us probably 3 or 4 days of difficult driving over very narrow, graveled, twisty mountain roads, I think we did in 4 or 5 hours over paved almost super highways.
Other than that, had the area changed much?
Yes, well, I can't remember it that well. The Leary Valley had changed a lot, and of course, the town of Cassino had changed greatly, been completely rebuilt, and the only ruin I saw last year was of the old castle. But the casino itself is being completely restored, and you wouldn't believe that it had been destroyed. It could have had been. But anyway, we moved across, and as you know, this was to be a joint attack by the 8th and the 5th American armies to crack the German defenses. The 8th Army was to operate on the right with the 5th Army on the left, with elements of the French Expeditionary Force under command. The crossing of the Leary was, if I can recall correctly, was to be done by British formations with support from the 1st Army Tank Brigade. I should say, at this stage, of course, we had been enlarged to become a Canadian Corps with the addition of the 5th Armored Division and the, I think it was the 2nd Army Tank Brigade, so that we had our own Corps commander, we had our own Corps troops, and we were able to operate as a full Corps formation within the Eighth Army. I think I made a mistake there. We did the 2nd Armored Brigade was not with us. We were augmented by the 5th Armored Division and Corps troops. And yes. Anyway, I was very fortunate in the battle of the Hitler line, in that in every major battle, some of us were chosen to be left out of battle, LOB'd. And I think this is the first time that I was selected, and the idea was that if the battalion should be wiped out, or almost wiped out, there'd be some elements left to reform it. And this almost proved to be the case in the Hitler line. And I wouldn't want my colleagues to know this, the ones who fought in the Hitler line, but I am my main battle during the time that the assault was going in was a vicious game of what we call Red Dog, where I was the dealer and managed to lose, I think, over $1,000 to my other colleagues who were left behind. But that was going to be short-lived. And that evening, I was told that I was to move up and to form a patrol at first light the next morning, and to go in and to see if I could find any, well, first of all, any remnants of Germans, of the opposite of the enemy, if there were any pockets of Canadians or any wounded, to find whatever I could. So at first light, we went in. The breakthrough had occurred the previous day on a very narrow front. There had been tremendous casualties. But the Germans at that stage were in pretty well full retreat on the way back to the Analfi River. But our patrol went in, and all I can say is that I never saw anything like it before or after, as far as the Canadian casualties were concerned. The German defenses were well organized in depth. They had barbed wire, minefields, dug-in steel turrets, dug-in machine gun emplacements, dug-in Tiger and Panther tank turrets, anti-tank guns. They had the trenches also, and perhaps one of the saving graces, I gather, was that they did not have the men to fully occupy these positions. But we could see, and I was in the area that had been attacked by the PPCLI, we could see where our people had penetrated the barbed wire. We could see the casualties. There was strikingly terrible evidence of where they had come up against these concrete emplacements where they had tried to get their explosive charges to crack them and had been killed while doing so. And it reminded me of what I had been meant to believe was the type of battle that was fought in me in the First World War. And it was a pretty terrifying sight. But anyway, we did not find any Germans, any live Germans. We did not find any live Canadians. We had to be very cautious about mines and that type of thing. And that evening, I was able to rejoin what was left of our company. I think the regiment had, in 2 or 3 hours, the regiment had suffered between 200 and 300 casualties, which is a very high number of casualties for what was an infantry regiment in that space of time. And similar casualties had been suffered by the C Force and the PPCLIs, who were members of the same brigade. But we, that evening, we had our position actually around a tank turret, an emplacement, a concrete emplacement, which the tank gun had been placed, or I should say the gun from a tank. And there were 13 tanks from the North Irish Horse that were supporting the Canadians, that were knocked out, obviously, by this one German tank gun, before someone had made a hit on the side of the tank turret, of the gun turret. There were numerous hits that were at the front, but the armor was so thick that the shells were not able to penetrate. It was only when they were able to hit the side and go through the narrower bit, the shell penetrated, and the thing, of course, blew up inside. This crazy gun was up in the air at a strange angle, and that photograph appeared back in Canada. I remember that pretty well. The interesting thing is that when we were back in Italy last year, we spent 2 days going through the Hitler line, and it's changed almost completely. The ground is all cultivated. I was able to find one pillbox, or one remnant of a pillbox, but I was able to find the emplacement for that Tiger tank turret. And it was at the same sort of crossroads, there were the same trees around it, and there's a little pile of bushes, and I said, that's where it was. And we went over it, and my God, there was the concrete emplacement still in place. The gun was gone, but the concrete emplacement was there. And still there was the same field of view that gun had had. So I think of all of our battles as a division, that this was probably one of the ones where we had suffered the most casualties in the shortest space of time. We suffered many casualties around Ortona, but that was over a longer space of time. And we suffered heavy casualties in the Battle of the Gothic Line. That again was over a period of almost a month, so it was spread out, but in the Hitler line, it was in the space of pretty half a day almost. It was quite horrifying. Well, from the Hitler line, there were pursuits. We ended up on the outskirts of Rome, and I get my geography straight, I think, I'm not sure, I think we must have had Florence by that time, but the outskirts of Rome, and the next major battle was the Battle of the Gothic and the Rimini lines, again over on the Adriatic coast of Italy. And this Battle of the Gothic and Rimini lines is apparently regarded as somewhat of a classic battle in the Second World War. I wasn't aware of this until I was approached by the Canadian Staff and Command College in Kingston, to take their students out to study this each year. And they very kindly asked me to go along as their infantry guest and advisor. And I objected on the grounds that I had been a young junior company commander, and I left the Army in 1945 and had entered the ranks of diplomacy after that, and therefore hadn't really kept a military connection. But they said, this is why we're asking you. And it's been a wonderful experience going back. And after studying other battlefields in Italy, I can see why they regard this as being the classic battle. But anyway, the...
Why was it the classic battle?
Yeah. Well, the classic battle, well, it had all sorts of ingredients. The successful invasion of, or liberation invasion, whatever you call it, of Western Europe had taken place. Both the 8th Army and the 5th American Army had lost formations to the forces in Northwest Europe. But the Germans also were on the defensive on practically all their fronts, and it was felt by the higher command that this could be the decisive battle in Italy, that if the breakthrough could be made to the Lombardy plains, that the road to Vienna was pretty well clear. And this was the sort of glittering prospect that was placed before the Allied troops. And there was to be quite a massive assault by the 8th Army along a fairly narrow sector on the